All right. Thank you. So we're going to have to mute. Oh, all right, here we go. I've only done this 30 times, but if everybody I know, people go in and out on mute, off mute, if you could keep yourselves on mute anyway. So that was the opening of this week's Culture Class. It was by the Brian Setzer Orchestra. You probably heard it in many movie soundtracks, but the reason why I brought that up, because you know that I always like to initiate with the theme song, is because it's about the glory and the excitement and the love of being an American. And I think a lot of us don't feel that way right now. And also other people, like people who are immigrating to the United States wanting to be an American right now. So it's just like, I don't know, the theme to get right in, because the first slide that I'm actually gonna show is that the public's mood right now in terms of this Pew Research poll is that just 17% say that they are proud when thinking about the state of the United States. So 17%, that's pretty crazy right now when everybody wanted to be an American before. I just wanted to help you see that viscerally. So I'm going to move forward, and I just want to reintroduce myself again. My name is Brad Grossman. This is basically the fifth culture class for the summer semester, but I've been doing this, I'm calling it a culture mass class. I started doing it basically the first week of COVID, which was March 18th. Well, people, as you know, decided, you know, we had the shelter in place basically on March 12th. Or March 13th, which was my 45th birthday, but I decided to have a free culture class on the 18th, and every Wednesday since then, we've been having a culture class, and I am the host, and my name is Brad Grossman, and I have a company called Zeitguide, which means guide to the zeitgeist, and for those of you who haven't been on or have heard me say this a million times, zeitgeist is a German word that means spirit of the times, and culture class is my newest product, and I've been doing it for companies, customizing it for them for the issues that they need to know or want to know, companies across all different industries. And when I'm dissecting the world of ideas and trying to keep track of the evolving narrative of culture, I'm always looking at these four big buckets of change, or these four big zeitgeist pillars of change, which are global trends, tech trends, consumer trends, and workplace trends. And I always ask my students or my audience to always think about these four questions about what are you learning? Why is it relevant to you? What can you or what should you do about these learnings? And how could you integrate these trends into your own business practices, strategies, company and sales strategy, decision-making and life? So moving forward, I just always want to start with, or I always start with what I have been feeling is the heartbeat of the week. And as you know, I started in week one, and many of you who have been in here, and again, I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but every week we have new people. I always have a theme of the week, and week one was March 18th, the first time I did it. Last week we took off. But I basically called it July 4th, a country divided. I know a lot of people who have been, you know, who experienced their July 4th weekend. There were some that were on Fire Island partying. I don't know if you saw that, or young people all over the beach, or other people in half the states where the virus is rising, not social distancing, not wearing masks. And then obviously we have other conversations, whether should we destroy all Confederacy image, whether they're statues or everywhere else, as well as the conversations about racial injustice. So many other things that have been dividing America, but I'm basically saying that this week in week 17 defines the zeitgeist right now as we're in a crescendo of global discord. So last week I felt about that it was more national discord, but after reading so many things, I basically illuminate, or I read and learned about in literally the last 3 days about all the global conflicts. And that's where I'm going to start. It's obviously going to be very depressing, but again, this is just to help you have a snapshot of what's happening in terms of a global discord. I would say that coronavirus was, as I always say, a magnifier of all the shit that plagued our society before, and an accelerator, hopefully, for the change that we really want to have. In the beginning of June, after George Floyd's death, we brought the conversation, which is a necessary conversation, about dismantling racial injustice in our country and in the rest of the world. And then this week, I feel like there was another thing just thrown into the conversation, what's happening, which is China, which I'm going to be discussing in a bit. And then after I go through my zeitgeist, which I just want to say that I'm going to run through a lot of things. And, you know, usually when I do this for my premium zeitgeist classes, culture classes, or for my companies, it's a full hour and I go much more comprehensively, but I'm just have time to zip through because we have two pieces of zeitgeist culture class towards the end, which everybody loves, which is the show and tell section, where I bring in somebody who has a really, or two people in the sense, Lindsay Nkrumah Farrar, who are the founders of Crown Magazine, which is a magazine for Black women, which is lifestyle, beauty, and fashion, but I'm gonna have Nkrumah and Lindsay talk about that. That's my show and tell section. And then Felix Salmon, who's the chief financial correspondent of Axios. And those of you who have been on Zeitgeist Culture Class for a while, you know that Axios is one of my favorite sources because they define the way that they report as smart brevity. And they have these amazing, amazing newsletters in all different categories. Felix is being one of them. But I am a proponent of smart brevity, but obviously I'm doing it live. So let's get started. I am just going to go through 20 examples very quickly of what's happening in terms of the zeitgeist of the crescendo of global discord. So I already talked about Trump versus some parts of the country, Trump's supporters versus the non-supporters, and Trump and the rest of the world. And on 4th of July, we talked a lot about, people wearing masks or people not wearing masks. And I just wanted to illuminate, actually, Felix from Axios. I just wanted to, you know, have this shout out because they did a poll with Ipsos that basically said that 50% of Americans report wearing a mask at all times. That's just 50%. So look at that stat. And I just wanted to add something because I know, Felix is also German. Felix, if you're there, this is an honor of you. If you missed this, Berlin's transport company basically is doing an ad campaign to make people wear masks by saying that people shouldn't start not wearing deodorant because then people will start wearing masks. Let's keep going with the
global. You've Zoomed. You've posted.
Which was there, which was Trump versus the World Health Organization. He's pulling out funding, he just said. We have just learned today that universities are suing the Trump administration's plan to require in-person classes for foreign students. So basically, they are filing a lawsuit that would basically against saying that foreign students will not have their visas if the universities, mainly MIT and Harvard, who were part of the lawsuit, do all their learning online. So there's a division. We are all knowing that a vaccine needs to come for us to really get through this. We can eliminate the contagion degree by social distancing and wearing masks, but we also saw how the mayor Bonham's from Atlanta actually just got it when she has been really, really, really careful as well. So we really need to fight this, fight for this vaccine. But on the flip side, it's going to be more divisions between those who believe in vaccines and those who are anti-vaccine. That conversation is going to start bubbling up. And in fact, Catholic leaders are already saying that they're concerned that the COVID-19 vaccine are using cells derived from human fetuses that would help us all be cured by the COVID. Keep going with the global divisions. There was a report in the New York Times recently that says that Latino and African American residents are three times as likely to become infected as their white neighbors. And actually, Black and Latino people have nearly been twice as likely to die from the virus as white people. So there you can see racial inequality. Here's a good thing about global division. Because of the George Floyd protests happening here, it has spread all over to the rest of the world, including Africa. And Africans from Kenya, from Uganda, from Zimbabwe, from Nigeria, are all basically, and others are all protesting against police brutality in their countries as well. So again, it's extending out to the global. We're going against the United Nations, who are basically the United States' killings of General Soleimani of Iran. They're saying that it's unlawful. So there's another thing. Yesterday, basically, our FBI director, Christopher Wray, basically said that China is a superpower. They think of themselves as being the only superpower in the particular world. Here we go. In terms of the here. Instead, China is engaged in a whole of state effort to become the world's only superpower by any means. And if you missed it, Reuters basically and others reported, I saw this tweet, that Pompeo really is concerned about TikTok, which many of us know is the new hot social media app that everybody's on. It's owned by a Chinese company called ByteDance. They're trying to they're doing a great job in terms of extending their reach to other people all over the world besides China. And because ByteDance is owned by China, Pompeo is basically saying that they want everybody in the United States to stop using it. So they're showing their concerns over that. So again, now there's a division between us and China. Instagram just reported that for everybody's who's in any type of company that relies on social media, especially Instagram, Instagram is creating a new app called Reel. Because India, because of their fight against the Chinese or the skirmishes that happen on the border, basically has banned TikTok. And this is the reason why Instagram is creating this new platform that's very TikTok-y, which I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about. They're expanding it to India. So then we have China and India. Basically, and here again, Felix, Axios, this is the best distillation of what's happening in China and Hong Kong right now, where there are laws, basically a security law, that's basically, I'll say it right from Axios because they so clearly define it, it's the clearest encroachment to date on the autonomy that has allowed Hong Kong to flourish as a global financial hub with political and legal protections unimaginable on the mainland. So, and they're also basically saying that if anybody speaks out against Hong Kong, against China's relationship and this law against Hong Kong, they will, if you ever come to China or Hong Kong, they will investigate you. And that's a story in development as well. But Axios and many others basically also talked about how this is also impacting the tech companies because Hong Kong and the tech companies are in Hong Kong, whether it's Google, whether it's Apple, TikTok, et cetera. Chinese are basically asking them to give all their data to the Chinese government. And most of the tech companies, the American-based companies, are holding back. Now, TikTok is an interesting case study because they actually said that they're going to be leaving Hong Kong, which is interesting. They want to be defined as other, you know, as a global social media platform. And I think they've had over 300 million downloads since the beginning of COVID. But, you know, TikTok, this is an interesting thing. They actually went further than all the other tech companies that basically have held back giving the data that the Chinese government is requesting. So here we have tech companies against China. The one company that hasn't really assessed this new Hong Kong law is Apple. Now, you know, like I said, Google, Twitter, and Facebook said they're going to pause processing user data requests, but Apple has not said that they would do that yet. So again, we know how much Apple does business with China. In fact, they've been, you know, producing chips and all, you know, hardware in China. So it makes sense. They were also very hesitant to speak about the Hong Kong protests during that time pre-COVID when protests were happening all over the world. Another division, we have been seeing a lot of advertisers boycott Facebook because of their refusal to flag the Trump, quote, looting and shooting like Twitter did, and also their dissatisfaction with Facebook trying to stop the spread of hate speech and misinformation. But that's also in conflict with a lot of direct-to-consumer brands who feel compelled that they should get off because of all the big brands. But you know what? This is the only way that they can advertise. They can't afford to be on television and do other things like the big brand. So here we have a division between the philosophy between some of these big brands and some of these smaller direct-to-consumer brands. And then this was just been in the, you know, last couple of days, but I wanted to show that the organization Stop for Hate basically recommended next steps for Facebook to actually move forward in terms of preventing this hate language from disseminating all over. And they gave 10 notions of accountability. The one that I thought was most interesting that I don't think most people are talking about is that they want there to be a live Facebook employee and that basically can be like a customer service representative. I know everybody in brands here are really, you know, interested in how to make customer experience so, you know, better than any other brand. And, you know, this is one thing. It's about having a live employee that anybody who's experiences hate speech or anything like that or sees hate speech, they would be able to talk to somebody and actually be able to tell them what they've seen. In the tech media, there's also a big division. Again, I'm looking at all four of the buckets. There has been a lot of controversy between tech, and I'm actually interested to see what Felix has to say about this, and tech media. So there, a reporter, Zoe Schiffer from The Verge, reported on the fact that Away, the direct-to-consumer suitcase brand, had a toxic work environment. And she wrote this article, which she's a reporter and she found that out. She should tell the world. I mean, that's what journalism is all about. It's the fourth estate. But there was basically a hate or disagreements all over social media from not only the CEO who was criticized, who said that the reporter was slandering, but also that the venture capitalist who put money into the company is basically saying how disgraceful the journalist was. Another division, I talked about facial recognition technology and how IBM and some other, Microsoft, said they were going to stop facial recognition technology because of their fear of privacy issues. And Apple basically said that they're not going to do that yet, and they're actually creating the facial scanning technique or capability in their new home kit. So you see Apple versus some of the other big tech companies. And I'm just going to go through the remaining, and then we're going to go with our Zeit guests. I'm really excited. Here's, we've been hearing about Congress's desire to regulate the big tech companies. So you have big tech versus Congress. And this actually is going to happen in July 17th, where they're going to have to go to Washington and, you know, they're going to hear them to see if they are being too monopolistic. Even Hamilton there showed some division. There were people who were saying that Lin-Manuel, the creator of Hamilton, and by the way, it was a huge success on Disney Plus. I think they increased their curve went like this when even Netflix went like this, which is insane. But people were criticizing Lin-Manuel, who basically reconstitutes the Hamilton and the founding father story by casting black and brown actors. Many of us know that. I'm sure many of you have decided to download Hamilton, but Lin-Manuel was basically criticized for not really talking too much about the slavery issue with the founding fathers. And basically he retorted that he said that, you know what, I did the best I can. So even like Lin-Manuel is getting pushback. So look at all these crazy division. It's not just one polarization. And I really do think the next conversation is going to be about the PPP. Now, Cindy Gallup, who was on a couple weeks ago, who taught us all about how to end racism in the corporate world, the PPP loans were just announced today. The SBA basically published every single company that got a PPP loan. And most of those on there were big brands and companies and startups that were owned by or companies owned by men and white people. And, you know, Cindy Gallup basically talked back and basically said, you know, black and color female founders, you know, you will be burning red hot with rage when you see the amount of companies and the juxtaposition and the percentage of who got it, who didn't. I feel that there's next going to be a boycott against all these big brands who basically took these big loans and the other people or the smaller companies, small businesses haven't been able to get it. So I am seeing those divisions everywhere. And this was by the way, 74% increase in subscriptions on Disney Plus. That was the number I had a brain fart. So that being said, I made a list of everything I just covered. So feel free to snapshot it to make you feel really excited about where the world is going. I'm going to scroll through this so people could take snapshots. But these, and there's so many others. I mean, even before COVID, we had like around 30 countries all over the world protesting. So the world was on fire pre-COVID. I kept saying that. But look where it is today. And it's division across all those sectors. Global, in our country, in technology, geopolitically, consumer-wise, and the conversations about work. So this is a good segue into the next subject, which, you know, is a lead in because there was an article basically, wow, the scroll, that another division, there's this conflicted cultural force in black publishing. And dovetailing with that, I'm really grateful that we have the founders in our show and tell segment, Lindsay and Nkrumah Farrar. And they are from Crown Magazine. And here it is. And it is I'll let them explain it, but here are some images. It's basically a magazine for black women. And it's print and it's really beautiful. And I actually learned about Lindsay when I saw an editorial she wrote, which I covered in Culture Class a couple weeks ago. And Lindsay, you know, who's the editor-in-chief of Crown, contextualize, you know, the importance of Black media, Black publishing. And I'm so honored to have her and her husband and her partner, Nkrumah, here to talk about Crown in our show and tell section. So let me unshare the screen. And Lindsay and Nkrumah, are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, thanks, Brad. Thanks for having us. And very informative beginning of the day or of the class.
That's what I kind of do. I'm trying to kill everything so people could just read Axios and watch Culture Class. Of course, there's so much there and I have to go deeper, but, you know, in the sake of time, here we are. So tell me about Crown.
Yeah, so
tell everybody here about Crown and the purpose for Crown and what it is, the story. Well, I'm just gonna sit back and listen. And okay. So is everybody else, clearly.
Co-founders of Crown Magazine. I'm the editor-in-chief and Nkrumah is the chief creative. And we are on a mission to be the most beautiful and honest representation of Black women in the history of print. No small feat. We set the bar very high.
Just print, not digitally.
We are print first. So we started off with
as you know, I was
always, right. Well, I have a couple. We have a literary journal which is about 130 to 160 pages, and a mag which is a little more bite sized and digestible. And the editorial that you referenced is in this one.
Yeah, show that in a sec. Well, I showed it. I would like you to talk about it in a second. But tell me more about Crown. So why did you create it?
This was the end of 2014. And we had a conversation that was a very casual conversation. I was in New York, living in Brooklyn at the time. And Nkrumah was still on the West Coast, which is where we're both from, where we met. And just started having a conversation about really the prospect. Really, we were in transitions in our careers and started, it was just one of those moments where it all kind of just, a conversation started. We started talking about print. I'm like, are you crazy? You know, a lot of our backgrounds came together and just looking at the climate at that time and the idea that Black women were really redefining beauty standards for themselves in real time, particularly in the YouTube space, so in the digital space, and having a conversation about what would that look like if we were to immortalize that experience in a print form? Really informed by the fact that we know from our experience as Black people, we've been terribly represented, particularly in print, in a tangible way for centuries. And so we thought it would be a really interesting way to build a direct-to-consumer brand around something that is physical in a digital age in a way to immortalize the story and this phenomenon that we were in the midst of. And, you know, kind of fast forward, 6 years now, we see ourselves in a very interesting time, in a time with very heightened sensitivity to race relations, obviously, in a time where, you know, there's now the Crown Act, where people are trying to legislate racism away and to make it legal or illegal to discriminate against people based on their hair. And so we really started the conversation around this psychographic conversation around natural hair, because so many women were taking this moment to say, no, I'm not gonna wear a weave or chemically relax my hair, which puts chemicals straight into my scalp. I'm going to wear my hair natural. And so it was really, that was a big part of that YouTube phenomenon was you're seeing these rituals that would normally be in like the intimacy of your home with your mom or your sister. Now they're broadcast across the globe. And so really formalizing that conversation.
And it was also, you know, Crown was started in direct response to a need. There was a hole in the market in the sense that Black women are amongst the most educated. Black women as a group are amongst the most educated in the country. But when you look at the media diet offered to Black women, it's celebrity and gossip driven and also very poor representations of at least the Black women in our communities and in our families that we knew. And we wanted to create something that engaged Black women in higher thought. Mm-hmm. You know, we have all these.
But what have they been getting before your magazine? Or, two questions. Can you compare yours to one that you actually respect in terms of media that has been before Crown? And what is the antithesis to what you're seeing in, I guess, in the marketplace pre-Crown?
I mean, in general, Black women have been hypersexualized. And the representations that we've seen, particularly on TV, is just a mess. Like, it just does not represent, if you, especially for an international audience looking at American media, the opinion that they would form, that you could form of Black people based on what is presented, you would perceive us as criminals, as sexual deviants, as uneducated, as poor, and it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. In terms of like making a comparison to something that we respect, it would be hard to do in a contemporary context. But you know, in the past, Ebony and Jet have chronicled the history of the Black American experience and have provided a range of representations for Black people.
Right. And at the time we were starting, I'm not sure, well, Jet is no longer. Ebony, yeah. I believe, was doing some things. I'm not sure. Essence Magazine was owned by Time Inc. And so there was a definite void in terms of the conversation that we were looking to have.
And what is the conversation you want to have?
Well, to Nkrumah's point, it's really engaging Black women in higher thought. So it's having conversations that are beyond just hair, beyond just beauty, beyond, you know, surface conversations, and reaching for depth of representation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not something that you can put in a listicle.
Yeah, but are there, you maybe, you know, this latest issue, what are some of the stories?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is our money and power issue. And some of the conversations that we have are reparations. One of the titles is Why I Just Turned Down $1 Million. And it's a founder talking about, you know, having a $1 million investment on the table, but the terms were terrible.
Yeah, and predatory capital and some, uh-huh. what some of the things that we experience as entrepreneurs, operating in a racist environment. Mm-hmm. You know.
The road to freedom, wielding Black political power with Karen Hunter, who has a very popular show on SiriusXM. Mm-hmm. You know, how to quit your day job. The things that, you know, Black women are, again, highly educated, also the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs in this country, have been so for some years now. But the fact remains that our community has very little wealth when you look at all of the numbers and the figures. We talk about that. Yeah. We own very little land. Even when we are the fastest group of growing group of entrepreneurs, our sales are, you know, are very slight as compared to our counterparts. Many of our businesses don't even employ an employee. And what does that even mean? It's dissecting and interrogating those things, which for a fashion or beauty magazine would not really be on the table. But for us, those are the things that allow us to access our true power. And then, you know, beauty and all that stuff is cute.
And it's the audience are Black women, you're saying. So do you see it going on beyond to another audience?
That's an interesting question to me. Yeah. And I think one of the problems in media and in creating Black media is that most of the Black media offered to the world is stories or content about Black people for white consumption. Uh-huh. And that is to say that it's Black storytelling, but made palatable for the world, instead of telling the story for a specific audience and just allowing the world to enjoy it. And so the magazine is much in that vein. Like, this magazine is very specifically for Black women, but smart white women all across the country subscribe and learn a lot from the magazine.
Mm-hmm. And Black men. Okay. But yeah, I mean, especially in these last several weeks, we've gotten an influx of interest and purchases from people outside of the target market, so to speak, but have been very thankful and have been very, just had very positive feedback. Like, I learned so much, because we're not trying to speak to translate. We're speaking to ourselves. We're reflecting our experience and our reality. And if you are genuinely interested in understanding, I think it is a very, it would be a very useful tool, mm-hmm. and a very important conversation, because it's really like, people are like, what can I do to help? How can I, It's this moment where it's hard to understand. And a lot of that is listen, you know?
But, you know, what do you think about everything that is going on right now in corporate America? I mean, are we all doing enough?
No.
Well, right. Short, to put it frankly, no. I mean, I left. I felt forced out of corporate America. Yeah. The culture was not compatible. And I found much more success as an entrepreneur, as a lot of my contemporaries have, or have tried and are, but they feel as though, man, I'm underpaid. It's a toxic work environment. I have to go to therapy just to make it through. All of these lists of things, I might as well try to do something else. And that's the current climate that we have. And that doesn't change because we post a bunch of social media posts. It's about the systems that are in place. It's about the cultures that are in place. It's about the tokenism, the feelings of Black women and Black people in these organizations that are not empowered to make change, that are not empowered even really to do their jobs half the time, aren't empowered to, you know, you bring in a Black vendor and they're questioning you if you have an existing relationship with this person, all of those types of things. And those things don't change overnight.
And it's interesting, like it's interesting how these conversations are framed, because they're not had in from a position of, or in a context of equity. Like, you know, even when we're talking about more tolerant and more healthy work environments and cultures inside of companies, we're talking about better conditions inside of white-owned companies. But the challenge is for white people in corporate to look around the room and say, hey, have I ever worked for a big company that was owned by a Black man? Have I ever worked under and directly reported to a Black CEO? Have I ever worked in a room and been the minority in the room? And the answer is always going to be no, particularly in businesses like advertising and media. And those are some of the questions that we need to be posing. And then the next thing is, why is that the case? And part of the reason is obvious, being that, you know, as Lindsay mentioned, you know, we did an article on predatory capital, and, you know, more generally speaking, our lack of access to capital. And yeah. Then when we do have access, the terms of engaging that capital are just ridiculous.
Okay. As I keep developing culture class, I'm like, I want to do it for 2 hours, but I don't really have the time. There's so much to talk about. And I know Jarvis, you say hi. You know, you're the associate producer helping me tighten this up. And he's putting quotes for everybody. Why don't you type in for everybody to tell them where they could get Crown Mag? And I hope everybody on this call subscribes. I wish you the best. Tough times for everybody, even with the COVID, I'm sure, and being I'm an entrepreneur, it's tough. So I wish you the best, and thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having us. Thanks, Jarvis.
All right. So we're going to move on to the media conversation. And I'm going to share the screen for 1 second. Again. Because this is the Hearts and Minds segment. Felix Salmon, who's been a journalist for so many years and has been on my radar forever. He just says it how it is, and that's why I'm excited to have him here. As you can see, Axios is one of my favorite sources to get content, and I know the people there, including the founders, and they are all looking at news and media in a really interesting, innovative way that all makes us smarter, faster, better, et cetera. So I want to talk about media today. I want to talk about some of the things that Felix has been thinking about, because he's thinking about all the time. And if you follow him on Twitter at felixsalmon.com, every second he has something to say. So Felix, thanks for being here. I'm just going to show your the site on Axios, which basically can illuminate just some of the stories that you've written in the last few weeks. And you also have a podcast, right, Felix? Are you there?
Slate Money. It's cool. Find it wherever you get your podcast.
And at Axios.com, you could sign up to Felix's
Axios newsletter. Edge is the name of the newsletter, yeah.
Yes, and it comes out every Thursday. Yes. Felix, can I ask you a question? Because there's always, do you have time to go over? It's fine if you don't.
Yeah, sure.
All right, cool. All right. So everybody, cancel your meeting afterwards and let's have some fun. All right, Felix, I'm going to stop share so we can see you. Thanks.
Hello.
Good haircut, by the way. Did you do your... And where are you right now?
Downtown Manhattan.
Oh, I'm in Manhattan now too. Oh, by the way, I love doing this. If everybody could just type in where you're from, we have like almost 40 people on today, which is amazing. So type in chat where you're from. I love doing that. All right, Felix. So Axios, why don't you explain what Axios is if I didn't do it justice?
I think you did a perfectly good job. It's basically we look at the world and we tell you everything that you need to know and nothing that you don't need to know in the minimum amount of time that we can just squeeze it all into.
And what gave Mike and the other partners, and you know, you're probably an early hire as well, or partner, maybe. Everybody's a partner, right?
We're all shareholders. I don't know if we're partners.
Well, good. Good luck. I'm sure you'll all succeed. So what is the reason why Axios came into being? What was like the white space that the founders saw?
Basically, I think it was the founders mostly came from Politico, and Politico, as you know, is a very fast twitch, and it's like, you know, who won the morning, who won the afternoon, what's the latest microscoop, and it's really great if you're a political junkie or you really care about that kind of thing, but it's way too insidery for the vast majority of people, and it's also a relatively narrow subject matter. I think what they realized was that in a world where there's just enormous amounts of information, there's a real need that people have to just get taken straight to what matters. Mm-hmm. And don't give me anecdotal leads, don't give me narratives, don't give me long discursive stories. Just tell me what I need to know, tell me what's new, tell me why it matters, and then let me get on with my life because I am busy. And if you can get me caught up on stuff super quickly, there's just in a very reliable way and in a scoopy way that like will break news as well as just tell you what other people are saying.
Then, right, you're not aggregating, you're actually doing...
Well, we are aggregating, we do both. And like the in a weird way, the audience doesn't care whether you broke the news or not, right? It's important to be out there, well-sourced in the world so that you understand what's going on and who to believe and who to trust and who not to believe. Like, you know, whenever there's a White House scoop, like 6 times out of 7, probably Jonathan Swan will be on Slack saying, yeah, don't ignore this one, it's crap, because we have the expertise necessary to be able to do that. But by the same token, if something important does happen, we're going to be out there saying, this is important, this is why it matters. We're not going to sort of ignore it just because we didn't break it. Our mantra is very much reader first, and so we'll give you what you need to know, and a huge part of that is not giving you what you don't need to know. What we don't print is massively important.
How do you distinguish between the two, what you need to know and what you don't need to know?
Just like, but we have one question which we try to apply to everything we write, which is why it matters. Like, tell me something, then tell me why it matters. What you often find with a lot of stories is that if you ask yourself, why does this matter, you don't really come up with a very compelling answer. And so if you can't answer why it matters question in a very sort of concise and compelling way, that's a really strong indication that the story probably doesn't matter, and that maybe the audience doesn't need to, we don't need to use up our audience's precious time by inflicting it upon them.
So yeah, so that you have to understand why it matters, basically. And why it matters in terms of like the reader, or just, you know, I just want to dig one step deeper. How do you figure out if it matters or not?
Well, I mean, we have different users which cover different industries. So, you know, it might be, why does it matter to this industry? It might mean, why does it matter to the reader? You know, I'm a financial journalist by trade, and I am naturally mistrustful of this trope that you find a lot of business journalists in, which is like, well, why does this matter to the reader? Like, you know, I'll be writing about, like, you know, the structure of the yield curve or something like that. And this is like important stuff which helps to govern the growth of the economy and the whole world. But like, not everything needs to come back to sort of like who's going to be the next president, or you know, how much money I'm going to make. It doesn't need to be personally important, but it does need to have some kind of an impact on the world that really matters and makes a difference.
All right, so let's shift to some of the stories that you've been working on. I showed a few. What are some of the things that are really top of mind for you right now that you really want to find out and know what matters for your audience?
So one of the things I'm really looking at right now is this new law that China has promulgated in Hong Kong, and the effect that that may or may not have on not only on Hong Kong, but basically on any company in the world that does business in China, which is virtually every country. So certainly every big company in the world. Mm-hmm. There's this provision of the law which basically says that it applies to everyone on the planet. It applies to you, it applies to me, even if we're here in the United States, so whatever country we're in, whatever passport we hold, we are subject to this law, and we can break this law. Now, in practice, if we break this law by posting, you know, pro-democracy sentiments on Twitter, say, from the comfort of our couch in Manhattan, there's no Chinese SWAT team is going to come down on, you know, from helicopters and arrest us. But if at any point we ever do go to China, and most of us do go to China on, you know, every so often, COVID notwithstanding, right, at that point we will be criminals because we will have broken the law. We will have broken Chinese law, and they can arrest us. Now, the fact is, the Chinese can arrest anyone in China for just about any reason or no reason. They've been doing that with Canadian nationals recently, as I'm sure you know. But this is an escalation of that, and it's part of what you've linked to previously from the FBI, basically saying that the Chinese are trying to use every tool at their disposal to become the second hegemonic power in the world. And having this kind of degree of extraterritoriality built into their legal system is definitely part of how the US projects its power globally, and it looks like it might become part of how the Chinese project their power globally as well.
You said in Axios, I don't think it was you, but maybe it was Brittany who does it. She does the China
beat. Bethany.
Bethany, yeah. Thank you. You know, she talked about a story about how there was like a Chinese student who tweeted or said something, a Chinese student in America or student in America from China who said something against the Chinese government. And then when he went back, he was arrested. Is that something that—
Right. And you don't even need to be Chinese. Like, yeah, they don't, like, as long as you're in China, they can arrest you.
Right. As long as you're in, so if I say something and I go to China, they could arrest me, basically.
Right. Yeah.
That's crazy. So, all right. So what are some of the other things that's on your mind right now?
So I was actually very interested in what you said about the PPP, because I think there's this really interesting sort of perceptions gap when it comes to the PPP, that you are like, well, look at the people who got it and the people who didn't get it, and look who the, like, who managed to get the money and the people who are left out. And there is a very broad sense, I think, when, you know, yesterday there was a lot of talk about the people who got it, and they were like, and there, a lot of the rhetoric surrounding that was like, think who got this money, who you know, the needier people who could have received this money and didn't. Which I think is all based on a bunch of chaos that happened at the beginning of the rollout. Before it was re-upped. The fact is there's $130 billion left over in the PPP. That basically everyone who applied for it got it. That you do not have a large number of people who, like, were left out, who didn't get it, who wanted it and weren't able to apply. Like, that you, it's always possible to find one or two here or there, sure, but, like, you don't have a— There was, in the end, no fiscal constraint on this. They had more money than they knew what to do with, and they've extended it even further in the hope that more people will apply for it. But like, it's very easy to turn all of these things into a kind of zero-sum game and say, well, yeah, look at all these rich people, Kanye and people like that, who applied for the PPP. And it's like, well, yeah, he did. But that doesn't mean that, like, he got money that would have otherwise gone to someone else, because there's, like, a whole bunch of money left over. But we are in this very kind of feverish time right now, in this febrile time of COVID, where everyone is feeling particularly righteous about more or less everything. And so, yeah, I think that it was almost inevitable that when the list of names came out, there was going to be, like, a bunch of righteousness on Twitter from the likes of Cindy Gallup.
Okay, so you disagree with her?
I mean, I think she's just factually wrong.
Because you're saying everybody who basically applied was able to get it.
And, yeah.
Okay. What about, I got a couple emails about people who were, you know, upset that the big brands got some when they didn't really need it. Is that...
I have no idea which big brands you're talking about. There was a handful of restaurant chains who got it, but that was about it.
Right. Okay. Any other stories? Any other things on your mind? What do you think about, like, what's in your heart and mind right now about the whole COVID situation? I mean, we've seen, like, I keep saying...
Well, as I say, I think we're super, super feverish right now. I think we're super, like... There was, what's his name, Dolnick in the New York Times today was talking about parentheses and how, like, we're in this weird, it feels like someone opened a parenthesis and we have no idea when or how it's going to be closed, right? We're in this liminal state, and
what's a liminal?
So I don't know if you know much about rites of passage and this guy Arnold van Gennep who more or less came up with the idea. But whenever you have a major transition in life, there's nearly always a rite of passage associated with it. You have the pre-state, and then you have the rite of passage, and then you have the post-state. And the rite of passage, whether it's, like, you know, a wedding or a bar mitzvah or, you know, you name it, some kind of weird, you know, ritual where you go out into the desert for 40 days and almost die, whatever it is, it has a very clearly defined end, and the ceremony itself, the liminal state, the in-between state, is kind of uncomfortable. No one feels very natural during it. And they all kind of breathe a sigh of relief when it's over, right? You know, when, like, if you go to a wedding and the officiant says, "Well, you may now kiss the bride," like, there's this big sort of sigh of, "Oh, phew, like, that's done, that's over, now we can go party, because, like, we've got to the end, we've got to the other side." And what we're experiencing right now is a really uncomfortable feeling of being in the middle of this state with no end in sight. And we have no idea when we're going to be able to sort of exhale and go back to normal, or whether that's going to be the case, or how that's going to be the case. And so everything is fraught, everything is extremely emotional, everything has become very righteous. And there have been definitely positive aspects of that, you know, like the whole broad embrace of Black Lives Matter would never have happened, I don't think, without that kind of feeling, that emotionality that the country is on edge. Like, there's a massive difference, as you know, in the broad social acceptance of Black Lives Matter among white folks compared, you know, in 2020 versus 2014 when it started. And so that's good, but there's just also this much broader feeling of feverishness in the country as a whole and the world as a whole, but mostly in the countries where COVID is still raging, like the UK and the US and in Brazil, where you kind of feel like anything is possible in a kind of dangerous way. And I think there's much more danger in the world. I don't know if you've seen the shooting stats are way up, the homicide stats are way up. Yeah, so it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in, and I think that is
domestic abuse, like, you know, mental health issues, domestic abuse, and
So yeah, that I think is this sort of like background noise to everything else that's going on right now, and it's important to just kind of look at the world through that lens and realize how incredibly unusual and artificial the current situation is.
And is there any hope?
No, I mean, we're not going to get out of this until, like, we close the parenthesis. And that's not going to happen until we have some kind of herd immunity through a vaccine. And no one has a clue, like, when that might happen, how that might happen, how we're going to get enough doses of the vaccine, how we're going to persuade people to take the vaccine. All of these things are deeply unknown. But, like, what is clear is that we have absolutely no hope or plan for reducing the prevalence of the virus in society. Like, every other country has been able to do it pretty much, but we haven't.
What is your opinion, why or why not?
It's because we have a weak and untrusted federal government. Like, there were a million things the federal government could and should have done and didn't do. And yeah, the fault really lies with them.
Okay. I'm also really interested in some of the stuff that you've been talking about in terms of the Jeffrey Epstein. You were kind of like on that very first, like, what, it's such a story and it's in your world, but if you're on Axios Edge and you're talking about, and there's so many different, you have such a broad scope of the subjects, but why, was that like an obsession for you? Did that come from your own volition that you wanted to, because you did an amazing job and you really illuminated really what that whole thing was about. And so
obviously the second shoe, we're going to see how much the second shoe drops now that Ghislaine Maxwell has been arrested. Literally, I'm looking out my window. You can't see my window because you're looking at me, but if you could see what I'm looking at, I'm looking at the MCC, the jail where Epstein killed himself, or didn't, depending on what you believe.
You don't have to say.
I've been fascinated by the Epstein brothers for many years. I spent a lot of time investigating and writing about Cooper Union, which is this college here in downtown Manhattan, where the chairman of the board was Mark Epstein, Jeffrey's brother, and there was a lot of financial shenanigans going on there. And no one really understood where Mark got his money. And there there's a lot of people talking about Jeffrey even back then. And so, yeah, I kept on following those things. I had a few connections at the MIT Media Lab, and so that whole story blew up, and I was interested in that. It turned out that Jeffrey Epstein was basically making donations to the Media Lab by sort of laundering them through Leon Black and Bill Gates, which is a crazy story, which I think has gone really unexamined. What is absolutely astonishing to me is that although Prince Andrew has sort of suffered the consequences or suffered some consequences for palling around with Jeffrey Epstein, a lot of other very, very rich and important men like Leon Black, like Bill Gates, like Larry Summers, like the list goes on, who have very documented relationships with this guy, seem to have suffered no ill effects whatsoever, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, so that'll be a story that you're going to continue now that Glenn was just arrested. For anybody who doesn't really understand that story or not into it, Jeffrey Epstein was somebody who is accused for sex trafficking and raping underage women and having this relationship with many rich and powerful men, and actually, you know, worked with a woman named Ghislaine Maxwell, who was his person who sought out and trained these women. He went to jail, and like Felix said, that he either killed himself or whatever you believe, a very rich man. But I know many of the people on the call might not know this. So if you want, just you know, read Felix's work. The other story that I just think is really interesting that you, you know, that you mentioned, everybody's talking about Facebook, right? And the Facebook boycott, I mentioned it as well from brands, right? You said something really interesting about how, and I read in your newsletter about how brands are actually, they might use this time or see if actually Facebook is effective. Am I getting that right?
Brands have been very suspicious about social media in general and Facebook in particular for some time now. It's never really proven itself as a great place for brand advertisers. And brand advertisers are not actually that important to Facebook. The top 100 advertisers only account for about 6% of Facebook's ad revenue. The vast majority of advertisers on Facebook are like small local businesses, or as you say, like D2C companies, which don't have the budget to really do big brand advertising. But once you grow to that big size of being able to do brand advertising and wanting to do brand advertising, Facebook becomes something which you kind of feel like you have to be on it, but you don't really quite understand why. And every so often you'll find companies like Adidas or Procter & Gamble coming out and saying, well, we just slashed like $200 million off our social ad spend and it had no visible effect on anything. And I don't know why we're bothering to spend it. Or like, you know, Google search ad spend or that kind of stuff. A lot of the money that is being gobbled up by the duopoly, by Facebook and Google, is really, you know, it's long tail stuff, and the brands, I think, are becoming increasingly suspicious of it. And so when you had Color of Change and the Anti-Defamation League and all of these other people, sleeping giants, coming along to the brands and saying, we want you to boycott Facebook for the month of July, they were really pushing it an open door. A lot of these brands were like, yeah, well, that's a great idea. We'll boycott Facebook for the month of July, and it'll be a great natural experiment to see if anything actually changes and if it hurts us at all. And there's a good chance that it really won't.
Do you think individuals are going to boycott Facebook now? Or do you think it's just something, because, you know, we heard today that, you know, people who are running civil rights groups, et cetera, don't think Facebook's doing enough. In fact, Facebook, they had this meeting, right? And they basically failed at what they wanted. So do you think that this will transfer not just with brands, but consumers in terms
of? There's been like low level, I know dozens of people who aren't on Facebook or who deleted their Facebook account.
But this is before.
You know, I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
Right. And this has never been enough to, you know, move the needle in terms of Facebook. I think there's this fallacy when it comes to boycotts. That, like, the way that a boycott works is that everyone joins the boycott. No one, you know, does any business with the company being boycotted. The company being boycotted thereby loses lots of business, loses lots of revenue, gets crippled, and has to change its ways or go out of business. And, like, that is really not how boycotts have ever worked. Like, with the possible exception of, like, the boycott on South African goods in the 1980s during apartheid, like, that, for normal companies, that's really not how it works. It's much more of a PR campaign. It's not a bottom line thing. And there's like, people are welcome to delete their Facebook accounts. It won't really make any difference to Facebook's revenues, because the fact is Facebook knows who you are, whether you have a Facebook account or not. My former colleague Kashmir Hill has written a lot about this, and people who have never had Facebook accounts, let alone people who've deleted their Facebook accounts, still get ads targeted at them every day by Facebook. And Facebook knows exactly who they are, and they know exactly who their friends are, and, you know, what their social graph is. Everyone is indexed by Facebook at this point, whether you have a Facebook account or not. And I think a lot of people don't realize the degree to which you are exposed to Facebook, to ads that ultimately make Facebook money, even if you never download the app, you never go to facebook.com, and you never, you know, even if you never go to Instagram, like, people, a lot of people don't even realize that Instagram is owned by Facebook. But even if you never
and use WhatsApp, any of those, right? WhatsApp?
Well, WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, but it so far doesn't have advertising. So it's not a major revenue source of Facebook. What it does do is it helps Facebook understand those social graphs. So if you're, like, on a WhatsApp group with a bunch of friends who are on Facebook, then Facebook can use that information to sort of triangulate you and your device and work out that when you visit a website and they'll serve you an ad on a completely unrelated website, that they'll know exactly who you are, who your friends are, what your interests are, what kind of ad to serve you. So, yeah, like, the idea that boycotting Facebook is like something that's going to harm Facebook, I think is another one of those fallacies that people don't really understand.
I, one last subject, because we're on that. What do you think about what's going to happen with the desire of regulations and to break up these big tech companies? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely the direction that we're moving in, certainly not under this administration, but potentially under the next one. You know, Facebook does get a huge amount of monopoly value from owning Instagram and WhatsApp, and Google gets a huge amount of monopoly value from owning YouTube and, you know, Google Maps. And so, like, if you break those things up and you start creating competition between them, competition for advertisers, competition for users, that can only be helpful. It's not obvious to me that that would be harmful to anyone. And it would help to break up some of the obscene scale that these massive global companies have. You know, we live in a world where people sort of mutter under their breath about someone like Twitter. Oh, only has 300 or 400 million users. That's nothing. That's not real scale. You can't really compete with that. In order to be a real force in social, you need to have 1 billion users or 2 billion users or something completely insane like that. And that just cannot be healthy. You become having you wind up with a degree of power that's almost greater than many sovereign states, because you know there's literally no country in the world that has as many people as Facebook has users.
That's really
not even China.
How many users do they have right now, Facebook?
Well, it depends how you count, but it's definitely in the billions.
Huh. And so, what do you think about TikTok then? In terms of, are they like could they grow as big as Facebook? It seems like their audience is growing.
Well, I mean, yeah, the growth is easy. To get to Facebook scale, no, you can't get to Facebook scale from TikTok alone. And they're certainly not going to get to Facebook scale if they're banned in India, which they are. Right. And also, they've never actually been in China, which is something I think a lot of people don't understand. like TikTok is, it used to be an app called Musical.ly, which was bought by ByteDance, and then it got rebranded as TikTok. ByteDance, the parent company, has a very similar app in China, whose name I forget. And they basically took that software and that algorithm and they ported it onto the Musical.ly base. But TikTok has no users in China and it's now been banned in India. Those are the two most populous countries in the world. So no, TikTok is not going to become as big as Facebook. It's impossible.
Could you explain why they decided not to, why to end their, you know, the platform in Hong Kong just recently?
Right, because Hong Kong is now, ever since this new law came in, Hong Kong is basically the mainland. It's basically China. The whole one country, two systems thing has gone right out the window. And so if you're not in China, then you shouldn't be in Hong Kong. So since they're not in China, they were like, we're getting out of Hong Kong too.
Interesting. So they really are defining, like you said, that ByteDance is, like, so China has access to ByteDance information, but ByteDance owns TikTok, but TikTok's not in China. So it's pretty confusing, right?
So Mike Pompeo is hinting very strongly that China has access to all of the data on TikTok users. TikTok, you know, vehemently denies this and says it's not true and that all of the information is held in the United States and there's all manner of firewalls and that China has no access to it at all. And so, you know, believe who you want on that one. But you know much more about TikTok this than I do because it's run by your friend Kevin.
Kevin Mayer. Yeah, Disney. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, he's basically telling, you know, the United States government that, you know, it's a great platform and they're not doing anything, giving anything to China. So, you know, he just had a statement that was just released, I think yesterday. So
do you believe him?
I don't know. I'm not, no comment. I don't think anybody believes anybody right now. Right. We're kind of like in this world of distrust. Nobody knows what's happening. So last question, which is a positive question that's being asked by Erica Berger, who is also a journalist. And she is wondering if you are all hiring, and I know this isn't your job, but are you hiring ahead of social good partnerships and impact?
No. She's saying that TikTok is doing that.
Oh, so are you? Oh, thank you. So is TikTok going to be? Yeah, no, yeah, no.
This is.
Laugh out loud.
This is Kevin. This is Kevin Mayer basically doing his like, you know, performative something something, and like saying, oh, well, so long as I have a head of social good partnerships and impact, then what, you know, I'm on the side of the angels.
Okay. Well, thank you for asking that. Can we end on a positive note?
No, there's really nothing positive in the world.
All right. Well, the one thing that's positive is that you came on Lindsay Nkrumah. That's a positive thing. I think their magazine's going to do well. And, you know, entrepreneurs, you know,
entrepreneurs just, you know, I've always been a little bit suspicious about this valorization of entrepreneurs. It's a very American thing.
Like fast company, every company.
There's a lot of like in the development world, there's a lot of talk about quote unquote micro entrepreneurs. But a lot of entrepreneurship and one of the reasons why you do see a lot of entrepreneurship in like, you know, the Black community and all of this kind of stuff, it's precisely that it's what you do if you can't get a job, right? I mean, most people, especially in this country, they really like things like health insurance. You know, they like job stability. They like knowing that they can make their mortgage payments for the next few years without having to worry about where that money is coming from. Like jobs, steady jobs and employment are like wonderful things and they're good things. And like good, like, especially like unionized jobs with job security are good things. And like, I think we should be valorizing like good union jobs more than we should be valorizing entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship is basically, sure, I can't get a good job with job security. I'm going to have to like you know, do this all on myself and take a huge amount of risk onto myself, which I don't necessarily want to take, right? Yeah, of course, there's not a possibility that I'm going to wind up making millions of dollars and that would be awesome. But like, I would actually quite happily give up that possibility of making millions of dollars if I knew that I would be able to make rent for the rest of my life. And so that's that, like having good employment prospects is much more important than entrepreneurship, I think.
Interesting. Well, I mean, the whole notion of entrepreneurship, and when everybody was on the cover of Fast Company, like it was Vogue and they were showing a celebrity, basically started. And, you know, during right after the financial crisis, because most millennials couldn't get jobs. So they kind of took it in their own hands to start.
And like, if you look at the sort of the classic sort of demographic makeup of the valorized entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, it's generally like childless white guys on the one hand. You know, it's people like, you know, anyone from Mark Zuckerberg to Bill Gates, who like drop out of university and start a company when they have nothing to lose and no real responsibilities and no families to support or anything like that, so they can take those risks. Or else it's people who've made a bunch of money already in Silicon Valley through like stock options or whatever, and they've got lucky, and so now they have enough of a financial cushion to be able to go out and take those risks. And there is, it's an inherently highly risky thing to do. And yeah, sure, if you have no children, if you have like no dependents, if you have no parents who you need to support, and if you have, you know, none of those worries, or if you have so much money that kind of thing doesn't matter, then entrepreneurship looks quite attractive. It's like a lot of upside and the downside is relatively small. But for most people, that's not the case.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens now, because a lot of entrepreneurs are definitely out of business now. So they're going to want to look for jobs. They're going to be fewer jobs. So they might have to be entrepreneurs, but there's no money. So it's going to be an interesting, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in that whole conversation. Anyway, Felix, thank you. Thank you for your time. Everybody read Axios, because you get to hear Felix and other like-minded journalists who believe in smart brevity, and it really helps you get a great sense of the world. Thank you for doing that. And Lindsay Nkrumah, thank you. Oh, thanks, Jarvis. You just sent everybody. Also, Jarvis, give Felix's Twitter handle, because, you know, he's on it all the time. Nkrumah and Lindsay, thank you very much. Again, everybody, thanks for coming to the Zeitgeist Culture class. We have five more in the summer semester. Next week, we're having Roxana Meron, who is a leading cardiologist and professor at Mount Sinai. And she isn't just going to just talk about COVID and its impact on hospitals and the world, but also about heart disease that doesn't get enough coverage in the press in women, you know, women who have heart attacks, as well as a high rate of heart attacks of Black and brown people. So she's going to talk about all those things and the future of healthcare. And I hope it'll continue to illuminate, and so we could all keep learning. And I'm blessed that this community keeps growing. And again, thanks, Felix. Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks, Nkrumah. And subscribe to Axios and get Crown Magazine. I'll see you next week, Wednesday, 2 p.m., same time. Bye.